I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a duelist opera. First movement, Ash Night, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. And Anne Cross. Monday, February 15th, 2410. 771 East Christie Avenue. New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. Anne Cross awoke on the first Monday of February vacation, the Avalon County Public School System's winter break, and lay under the covers, spending several long, blissful minutes savoring the fact that she still had a whole 7 days without homework. 7 more days without classes. Not that school was a bad thing. This semester was the first time since she'd been 12 that she'd been able to go to a normal school. And since Harkness Street High School wasn't anything at all like the cram school she'd gone to on Oron 4, and the Psi Corps hadn't spoiled anything yet, she loved every minute of it. Well, except for the pop quiz in math that Professor Reintaler had sprung on them Friday morning, when Anne hadn't done her homework. That hadn't been so much fun. And she was pretty sure she hadn't got more than 6 of the 10 questions right, so she was probably going to have to explain it to Miki. Oh well, I'll burn that test paper when I get it back, she thought cheerfully, and went in search of breakfast, and to find out what Caitlin's plans for the afternoon were when she got back from her morning class. Since Sionji had vanished off on whatever he was doing shortly after New Year's, and Caitlin's dad's students had gone back to learning from him, Anne presently had the unique and somewhat painful distinction of being her sensei's only student, and Caitlin had couched her decision to allow Anne to attend Harkness in the requirement that she earn the right to stay there by continuing to improve in the dojo. However, Caitlin had a morning class and another one right after lunch at New Avalon University, over in Salutown, and it was her habit on such days to stay on campus. With Juri working and Miki still on Tomodachi, that left Anne alone in the house. Well, alone except for the majordomo, anyway. 6 months ago, Anne doubted she'd have been able to handle this particular facet of the new housekeeping she and Kate had set up in New Avalon. She could handle moving back into a city. Compared to the planetary sprawl on Oron 4, the city in the sphere was practically a little town with a well, and it had so much more spirit and character than any place in the corporate sector could dream of that living there dredged up no bad memories. The 3-story townhouse Caitlin had found in the city's extra-quirky Claremont district suited the two quite well, both in its own right and in terms of access to the rest of the city. It had plenty of room for guests, the flat roof made an excellent practice space, and the inside was every bit as homey and comfortable as the house on Wildwood Road, albeit in a completely different style. It even had a decent little backyard, with a cherry tree, albeit not one as impressive as the one out back of 1140 Wildwood, room to host a modest-sized barbecue party, a place for a hammock, and a surprising amount of room for a city yard. The house came with a droid majordomo, though, and that had been one of the defining factors of life in the privileged classes on Oron 4. Household majordomo droids in the corporate sector were ubiquitous appliances and treated as such. They never had names, only coded manufacturers' designations, and they were programmed to do their duties with as little interaction as possible with the home's human inmates. They had no personalities, no interests, and no compassion. They were, in short, not very much fun for a child to be stuck at home alone with for long periods of time, which had happened quite a lot to Anne in her younger days. When she learned that the townhouse in New Avalon had one, she'd wondered with some nervousness how she would take to having one around again. She needn't have worried. The majordomo that came with 771 East Christie was as unlike the cold, uncaring, mechanical boss of her childhood home on Oron 4 as the house itself was unlike the bland, plastic company flat that childhood home had been. For one thing, he had a name. "Morning, Fritz," she said cheerfully as she reached the bottom of the stairs. Fritz, more correctly F3PZ, a Cybot Galactica 3P series protocol droid, paused in vacuuming the hall carpet and turned. "Ah, good morning, Miss Anne," the droid said in a pleasant voice with a slight German accent. "Miss Caitlin left a note for you on the refrigerator. She expects to be home about 3. "Okay, thanks," Anne said, and went on to the kitchen to collect the note. She found it was a list of 3 kata with a detailed list of where in them she was getting unacceptably sloppy, as well as a less formal request to see if she could figure out what was the matter with the stuck window in the south bedroom. Anne chatted with Fritz about the year's prospects for the Knights, spring training in 2 weeks, while the droid made her a breakfast of Johnny cakes and bacon. After breakfast, she went back upstairs and dressed in clothes that would handle either a workout or some minor home repairs, leaving Fritz to finish the vacuuming. Several hours later, Anne lowered her Bokuto, Toneri Koken. She had named it over Christmas, after a discussion with Liza Schustal about the importance of named weaponry, and considered that her morning had been well spent. With a combination of telekinesis and the heat of her swearing, she had successfully dislodged the stuck window, which had been painted shut by some misguided previous owner, without breaking the glass, after which she'd scraped off the misapplied paint and touched it up with some fresh semi-gloss. Then she had virtuously gone to the roof and worked through the first of the kata she was having difficulty with, and if she hadn't gotten it perfect yet, well, at least she was pretty sure she was better at it than she'd been. She was contemplating going in to see if Fritz had started lunch yet when the faint scent of grilled cheese sandwiches reached her from the kitchen vent. Anne grinned and slipped Toneri Koken back into the cord she used to carry it. "My timing's good," she said cheerfully, and turned to leave the roof. She had just reached the first landing when there was a screaming distortion of light and the walls of the stairwell fisheyed around her, bending in to grab at her head, then bulging outwards as if some giant blast of air had exploded where she was standing and was pushing them out. The next instant, everything was normal, and she was staring out over a white stone balustrade, surrounded by nothing but the gentle whisper of wind. Understandably, she was a little disoriented. She stepped back from the railing, turned, and looked around her. She seemed to be on a large balcony, jutting out from about 3/4 of the way up a high, narrow stone tower with a clock at the top. Below, spread out like a postcard, was a cluster of buildings with terracotta roofs and lots of archways. Beyond that was a white stone plaza with a long, shallow stairway leading to what looked like a walled forest. Something about it looked familiar, but Anne couldn't place it. She had the feeling she'd seen it before, but when was eluding her? It was a strange feeling to have. She raised a hand to shade her eyes and peered toward the forest. "Did I dream I was here?" she wondered. "Or have I been here and just don't quite remember it?" "Hey," a voice cried behind her, breaking her concentration. "Hey, you!" She turned, blinking into the shadow of the tower which fell across her at the sun's current height, and saw only a shadowy figure of a woman approaching at a brisk trot. "Oh, it's you!" said the woman with definite relief in her voice. "Thank God, I thought... Hey! Wait! You aren't you, you're somebody else!" Anne stepped further into the shade, her eyes adjusting, and said, "That's kind of existential, don't you think?" Now she could more clearly see the young woman who'd emerged from the tower to accost her. She was about 10 years older than Anne, a pointy-chinned young woman with thick, wavy, ash-blonde hair that flowed around her shoulders, picking up green highlights from her double-breasted jacket. Her indignant green eyes were a few shades darker than the highlights in her hair, which made for an interesting effect. She put her hands on her hips and demanded, "Who are you? How did you get up here, and why are you wearing that uniform?" Anne blinked at her. "Uniform? What uni..." Then she glanced down at herself and realized the woman meant Utina's unbuttoned jacket and the red cargo pants. "Oh. I asked you a question," the woman reminded her. "Actually, you asked me three," Anne replied blandly. She went back to the railing and looked down at the buildings. "My name's Anne, but I can't answer your second question until you tell me where here is. I'm not even sure what planet I'm on." "You're not on any planet," the woman replied. "You're in Sephiro. This is the campus of Tenjo Academy." Anne blinked, turned around, and felt the pieces of familiarity click into place. She hadn't climbed the bell tower the previous summer when they'd stopped here on the tour, but now the perspective made sense. And she turned back to the woman. "You must be Kanai Otori, then." "Must be a bit weird running a school for somebody else that used to be named after your family." "Well, we didn't do a..." Kanai skidded to a verbal halt. Comprehension dawned on her face. "You're a friend of Prince Tenjo's from Midgard, aren't you?" Smiling, Anne squared herself and bowed. "My name is Anne Cross. I'm a novice samurai of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu, second student of Master Caitlin Hutchins, Utena's best friend. I've known her, both of them actually, for a little over a year now, and I visited with the Art of Noises tour last summer, but..." "Do you have any idea how I got here? A minute ago I was on my way to lunch." "No, but this can't be good," Kanai answered her, a frown creasing her smooth forehead. "Where's the pillar? Or Utina and Anthe, or the Rune Knights?" "Utina and Anthe are still on Tomodachi. Probably at lunch, too, at this hour. I'm not sure where Corwin is at the moment. He's been busy lately with something. I think the Rune Knights are all still in New Avalon, but I could be wrong. Why?" Kanaya looked around, went to the edge of the balcony and looked up and down, as though checking the area for something. Then she drew a deep breath and shrilled, "Master Clef!" There was no appreciable response. "Now I'm really worried," Kanai said, turning to glare accusingly at Anne. "Master Clef has never been missing when I needed to find him." "I was in the forest," came a voice from the doorway. "Even I can't cover that distance instantly." Anne and Kanai turned to see the diminutive form of Clef, the Master Mage of Sephiro, standing in the doorway to the tower. He'd looked better. His robes were rumpled, soiled, and torn, and there was a bloody mark on the left side of his face. He leaned heavily on his beaked staff, his calm face drawn. Kanai looked stricken. "Master Clef, what in the world's happened to you?" she asked as she and Anne both rushed to the mage's aid. "There are demons in the forest," Clef replied, drawing himself up to indicate he needed no help. "I was trying, and failing, to get rid of them. They are too strong, and with something striving to cut the 10th world away from the rest of creation, my strength wanes." He looked Anne up and down. "You must be the one the summoning brought. I had hoped for at least one of the established knights, if not one or more of the Trinity, but you are all I have." "Well," Anne replied with a confidence she didn't entirely feel, "maybe I'll be enough. Give me the short version. It sounds like time is running out." Clef blinked. "Aren't you going to get angry and demand to be sent home?" No, not especially. But what would happen if I did?" "Nothing. I cannot spare the energy. And if you take no action, Sephiro will fall into the abyss, the Trinity will most likely die, and whoever is causing this will have won a victory against us all." "Forget that. The Trinity have all saved my life at least once each, and they're all good friends of mine. Give me the short version and let's get busy." "Very well," Clef replied, delight touching his face despite his obvious pain, dread, and fatigue. Someone has poisoned the guardian trees, weakening the defenses that lead to the dueling platform and the castle in the roots of the world tree. If they gain access to the platform, they can wreak all manner of havoc and cast Sephiro into the void. If the pillar were here, or the prince, they could stop this erosion in a moment, but... He shrugged. I failed to summon them. You will have to do. Go to the Forest of Secrets, climb the steps to the dueling platform, and from there you should be able to see what they are doing and stop them. Miss Otori, you and I must remain here to help guard the world engine from attack in case... He paused, looking at Anne, and Anne filled in the rest of the sentence. In case I fail, yeah. Clef nodded wearily. My strength is nearly spent. Anne checked the cord across her back that she used to keep Toneri Koken with her. The Bokuto was, comfortingly, still there. Then she remembered something Fu had mentioned once when she'd told the story of how they had become rune knights. Do I get anything else to work with, or... Clef shook his head. If you have any sorcerer's potential, I haven't the strength to awaken it now. He gave a wan smile. I'm afraid you'll have to take what you brought with you, except for this. He handed her a small object taken from an inside pocket of his robes. You'll need it to enter the forest. Anne looked at the item he'd given her. It was a silver ring, a wide band with a pink rose signet. Very familiar looking. She'd seen the same symbol a thousand times, in the bottoms of Utena Tenjo's teacups, and on the identical ring she and many of her friends wore. It hadn't been long ago at all, in fact, that Caitlin had told her she would soon be ready for her own. A duelist's ring, she mused. She felt a completely inappropriate grin, given the situation, spreading across her face as she slipped the ring onto her left ring finger. The signet flickered, then changed color, deepening to a rich amber. Clef raised an eyebrow. Then he seemed to reach some conclusion as he shook his head, straightened, and looked her in the eyes. Now go. Time is short, and you seem to understand, unlike some others I've had to brief over the years, the need for urgency. Right, I'm gone, said Anne, and with a nice to meet you, can I? Tossed back over her shoulder, she dashed into the tower, found the elevator, and started down. Clef sat heavily down at the little table out on the balcony, sighed, and looked up at Kanai. I hope she's enough, he said. Could I trouble you for an iced tea or something, Miss Otori, while we wait for the elevator to return? I'm parched. Kanai stood at the railing for a few moments, watching the black speck of Anne's uniform jacket moving swiftly across the plaza toward the stairs to the forest, then turned around. Sure, she said. Anne stood in front of the great door to the Forest of Secrets, panting slightly from her headlong dash across the campus and up the shorter flight of stairs, and eyed the door. Now, how did Senpai do this? She muttered, looking over the elaborately carved door for any sign of a socket or such like that the ring might fit into as a key, but found nothing. Well, she muttered to herself, glancing down at the ring and then setting her right hand to the door. Master Clef said this would let me in. She gave the handle a tug. It yielded not at all. She tugged again, with both hands this time, and something cold and wet splashed her fingers. With a wordless exclamation, she yanked her hand back and shook the water from it. Underneath her, something ancient and heavy moved with a tremendous grating clunk, and water began gushing from ducts set high in the walls along the walkway, pouring into the gutters to either side and curtaining the doorway. Stone scraped on stone. She had the impression of more ancient mechanisms moving, changing the shape of things hidden behind the water. Then it was gone, churgling away into the drainage system under the walkway, and the wall and door had become the open archway topped with an intricately carved stone rose that she remembered from last summer. She paused and offered a silent prayer to the gods and to her teacher. "Please don't let me screw this up." Then she loosened Toneri Koken from its bindings and slipped through the door as quietly as she knew how, looking for the tremendous flight of stairs up that she had climbed with Sionji during her previous visit. It wasn't there, at least not that she could see. It was dark in the forest, much darker than it should have been given the brightness of the sunlight outside, and she had a hard time seeing at first. As her eyes adjusted to the lower light, she started to make out the shapes of individual trees, but there was something wrong about them. She stepped closer to one of the nearby ones, peering more closely at it through the gloom, and then stepped back with a gasp of shock and disgust. The tree looked like it had once been a fir, but that was before some horrible thing had taken hold of it and twisted it. It was hideously misshapen now, drooping and gnarled, almost denuded of needles. It looked almost more animal than vegetable, like a knotted, cramped muscle jutting up from the ground. Anne fought down the urge to be violently sick and turned away, resolving not to look more closely at any of the other trees she encountered in here. She walked slowly, softly, deeper into the diseased forest, feeling her guts churn in sympathy with the tortured trees. She wasn't sure what she was looking for, only following some silent instinct as she delved deeper into the woods. Suddenly, she heard a voice. Not words, just a voice, indistinct in the distance. She pressed on, following the sound, one hand on the grip of her bokuto. There were two voices, she realized as she got closer, both men's. One was a little deeper than the other, which was familiar. She felt a sinking sensation in the pit of her stomach. "This is supposed to help us find the stairs," the familiar one observed sardonically. Anne paused, ducking behind a large rock. She thought they were nearby, perhaps less than 10 feet now, though noises in the forest carried strangely. Still, it didn't seem that they'd heard her coming. "The trees hide the stairway from us," the unfamiliar voice replied calmly. "This is the Forest of Secrets, after all. The trees only show the way to those who are supposed to be here." A pause. Then the voice went on with an ironic tone that put Anne in mind of a wry grin. "That wouldn't be us anymore, Sionji." "Oh, fuck." "It's interesting that trees can divine intent," said her senpai's voice, and she heard the crushing of leaves underfoot as they continued to walk along. "But even as sick as our little present has made them, it'll take these trees forever to actually die. And the mage escaped us. He's going to call for help." "With luck," said the other voice, "they'll lose their power some time before actually dying, and well before that little runt can bring in anyone who can handle us." "That's as good an opening line as any," Anne thought. She stepped around the rock, hand on Bokuto, and said with an authority she didn't quite feel, "Hold it." Two figures turned to look at her. Her eyes were now quite well adjusted to the gloom of the forest, and she could see them well. One of them was Sionji, and she saw an expression of shock and dismay flicker across his face before his expression closed down into what she'd dubbed inscrutable psycho mode. The other was another young man, perhaps 5 years older than Anne's own age of 15, tall and red-headed, with very long, straight hair. He was carrying something large and blocky in his hands. Sionji's hands were empty. Both of them were wearing a kind of black uniform that made Anne think of Jedi Knights for a moment, and both of them wore lightsabers at their belt. She realized with a shock that Sionji had cut his hair. What was left was slicked back in a sleek, military sort of cut. The redhead's long hair was loose, maybe in an attempt to cover the garish red marks on his face. Anne knew other people with facial markings. Corwin Ravenhair, who had his because he was a god, and Anthy Tenjo, who was a sort of cousin to the gods, came to mind. These were different from Corwin's clean, regular, deep blue brands, or Anthy's small forehead pip. They were bright, livid slashes of red, slanting together in the middle of his forehead like the exaggerated false eyebrows of painted face players, and double scarlet triangles on each cheekbone. According to Corwin, those were the marks of demons, or of the damned. Anne drew her Bokuto. "I don't suppose," she said, keeping her voice even, "I could convince you to just give up and go back wherever you came from." She carefully avoided looking at Sionji. Whoever this other guy was, Sionji had to have a reason for what he was doing. The redhead smiled. He must have been handsome once, and probably still could be, even with those marks on his face. Clearly he thought he still was, as he replied in a silky voice, "Well, well, what have we here? Did Clef actually manage to summon one of his rune knights? I don't recognize you from last time, baby. But then, you would have been too young to be in on that, wouldn't you? I keep forgetting how long ago it was." Anne gave him a cool look as his words connected the last links of memory for her. Tall, broad-shouldered, red-headed, handsome in a slimy sort of way. Calls girls baby. You must be Toga. His smile widened a little, and his eyes smoldered. The effect was utterly wasted on Anne. "I'm afraid," he replied smoothly, "I haven't had the pleasure." Anne looked him up and down and replied, "You don't look it. You weren't going to, either, at least not from me." She smiled coldly and went on, "Live guys who think they're pretty don't appeal to me, let alone dead ones." Toga frowned. He said, "I see. So it's to be that way? Very well." His eyes focused on something behind Anne. She resisted the urge to turn and look as he smiled, slyly rather than seductively this time. "Sionji, kill her," said Toga. "I'm off to destroy the world tree." With that, he sprinted past Anne and disappeared behind a tree. Anne whirled and saw, through the twisted trunks of a group behind her, his target, the gleaming white column of the stairway to the sky, just shivering into view. It had been back near the entrance, after all. But the trees, confused by their death agonies, had hidden it from she who was supposed to be there, as they now revealed it to all. She spun back to stare at Sionji. "Are you going to let him do that?" she demanded, aghast. "Senpai?" He drew his lightsaber, ignited it with a flick of a finger, and leveled it at her. "Defend yourself, Juniper," he ordered, and launched himself into an attack. Anne stared at him in shock, only realizing at the last instant that he wasn't pulling his blow. She dove out of the way, felt the lightsaber whip past her head and sever an errant strand of hair that had escaped her braid. She came to her feet, and he turned and swatted her Bokuto out of her startled hands with an almost contemptuous blow. Sionji tisked softly as she scrambled to her feet and pulled the Bokuto back to her hands with her TK. "You're not using anything like your full ability against me, Juniper. I know you're better than that." She stared at him with an expression of horror.
"Senpai," she whispered, "you can't really mean to just let that demon go kill Anthy, Utena, and Corwin."
He smiled sardonically. "I suppose that depends on whether or not you stop waiting for me to get out of your way and actually put some thought into what you're doing instead." He raised his lightsaber to a very deliberate-looking block position. The sleeve slid back on his arm, and Anne noted his left wrist was bare. Wait. His left wrist was bare? "Juniper, I have to go away for a little while. I need you to keep this for me. Don't open it. Just keep it safe until I come back to claim it from you."
Sure. What's in it?"
"Nothing bad, but something I need someone else to keep safe for a little while."
"I'll keep it safe for you, Senpai."
"His lens is in there," she realized with shock, dodging out of the way of another sizzling lightsaber blow that was close enough to leave a smoking slash in the front of Utena's jacket.
"That means his mind isn't shielded. I can scan him."
Anne dropped her shields and, summoning every ounce of training Carmela Sunderland, Devlin Carter, and Jean Grey had helped her with, reached for his mind. She got a wash of concern from his entirely unfamiliar consciousness. She'd never actually touched it before. Overlaid with a feeling of frantic haste and a mostly suppressed note of panic, well mixed through with frustration.
"Does he want me to beat him?"
Anne frowned, then clenched her teeth together and brought her bokuto up to parry the lightsaber. She'd seen Corwin parry Sionchi's lightsaber with stick the couple of times they had sparred in the dojo, and Teneri Koken was made of the same wood. Belatedly, she hoped that was all there was to it. She'd feel awfully silly if there were some other enchantment involved. But only for about a second. His lightsaber fetched up against the blade with a harsh fizzle of sparks, and his eyes lit up for a moment. She got a warm flash of approval through her touch on his mind. The nasty, suspicious knot she'd had in the pit of her stomach released a bit. "I did read him right." Anne caught her lower lip between her teeth and followed up on her block by disengaging and then swinging for his legs, aiming to knock him down. He dodged away.
"Juniper, it's not going to be that easy."
Anne met his eyes, felt the desperation behind his bantering tone. She bit down on her lip, drawing blood, and did the one thing that she wanted least in the world at that moment. She let out a wordless yell of frustration and lunged forward to engage Sionchi in a real, potentially deadly duel. His saber stung the air, clashed with her bokuto, and made an awful screeching noise. She jumped back, disengaging as he tried to overpower her with his superior strength. On the way out, he tried a strike that he'd disarmed her with in the dojo more than once. She'd learned the counter to it since he'd left on whatever this mission was. She gasped, shifting her grip on the bokuto, rolled the wooden sword over his plasma beam, extracting another shriek from the saber as she did so, and dodged out of the way. She felt the saber catch for the briefest of instants on something, and then felt a cool draft on her left side. "He must have caught Utena's jacket again," she thought distractedly, never taking her eyes off him. "You've improved," he observed dispassionately, fencing with her with a flurry of small strikes that she dodged rather than parrying.
"Sensei only has one person to beat on,"
Anne gasped, then came up around the last of the little strikes and swung at his shoulder, aiming for the joint in hopes of getting him to drop the saber. He whipped his saber round and parried, and Anne silently cursed the speed at which those things could be manipulated. He gave her an evil little smile. Behind it, she could feel his frustration, as he added,
but you're still too worried about actually hurting me. 'Cause I don't want to, she gasped, just barely jumping away in time as the saber neatly carved the air around her midsection and left another torn gash in the jacket. This time there was a moment of freezing cold, and then the bloom of a burn on her skin. Then you will lose. Sayanji's voice was glacial. Just like a samurai against the ocean waves. And so will everyone else. Anne dodged back from another sizzling blow, and watched as Sayanji shifted his stance slightly, and brought his lightsaber up into an almost classic pose to begin a duel with. His mind radiated anticipation and hope and fear and frustration, and hers kicked into high gear. Rakugato and the Seven Waves, she thought. That's the third kata I ever... Ah! Point taken, she gasped, and lunged forward into the opening move of the kata. His aura blasted approval at her even as he caught her blade on his, and counterattacked back with the overpowering force of an incoming wave. Anne ducked under much of it, crouching down and blocking over her head, until his saber shifted to the position she knew was coming. She surged upright, knocked it away, and dodged behind him. Caitlin had taught her this kata early on in her training, because it was good practice for a novice trying to stay alive and not caring whether it looked pretty. But she hadn't really gotten it until she'd practiced it in the surf on the beach at the Jezebel Resort with Sayanji. The point was to learn how to dodge under the attacks your opponent was throwing at you, and then to come up after the worst of them had gone by, letting them flow past you rather than parrying. It was a good kata for someone who didn't necessarily have a lot of upper arm strength, and compared to Sayanji, Anne still didn't. She flowed around his attacks as she could, remembering the feel of the water buoying her up on the beach, blocking when she couldn't dodge according to the pattern of the kata, and she let her body take over. This she didn't have to think about. This she knew. She knew how it was going to end, too, and that was where she was going to have to alter the pattern. Then she was there, and his final strike slammed down above her, and she surged upward, bashing it off to her left side and leaving him open. She felt his mind clench in anticipation of pain, and her bokuto flashed toward his neck to behead the last wave. She adjusted the whipping path of her sword upward 8 inches. The blow caught her senpai on the hardest part of his skull with nowhere near the full force of her arms behind it. With just enough force, she hoped, that she would only knock him unconscious and not shatter his skull. As the wooden blade hit, she was nearly knocked over by the blast of pain emanating from him. She was as wide open empathically as she'd been when she first discovered her peculiar gift, and she wondered if she was going to black out too. Then Sayanji toppled. Anne felt a thin trickle of approval from him, overlaying the pain, before his consciousness faded to the soft humming of life without awareness. She stood there, panting for a few moments, as all the excess panic that had been pounding at her slowly drained away. Then she knelt, put 2 fingers to his throat, and found his pulse. It was fast, but steady and strong. "Oh, thank you, gods," Anne murmured, and with careful fingers she touched the goose egg she'd just given him. She couldn't feel any cracks in his skull. "I'm glad you've got a hard head, senpai," she informed her unconscious friend. Concern for him warred with her sense of responsibility. "And I hope it's just a concussion, because you'd beat the shit out of me if I stayed here to take care of you instead of dealing with Toga," she muttered, snatching up her bokuto, and ran to the foot of the staircase, looked up at the huge number of stairs. "He's got to be almost to the top by now." She tilted her head and shoulders back to look up at the staircase. No way to climb fast enough to overtake him. No time to wait for the elevator. But... She gathered herself, focused her will, and leaped. Telekinesis and a lifelong habit of escape acrobatics combined to throw her up 3 levels,
to land at the edge of the spiral. She remained there only long enough to gather for another jump. In 20 seconds of furious exertion, she had reached the last curve, at which point she took to the steps, ran the last 270 degrees at a dead sprint, and barreled through the archway onto the dueling platform, yelling Toga's name at the top of her lungs. He was kneeling in the center of the platform, having set down the thing he was carrying directly on the huge rose seal inset in the floor. "Toga, you are so dead," she snarled, all her pent-up rage at having had to knock Sionji unconscious, fueling her charge across the floor towards him. He froze, then his head snapped up, eyes wide with surprise. "You," he blurted. "Sionji?" "He's done," said Anne, "and you're next." She pointed the Bokuto straight at his nose, the tip bare inches from his face. Toga looked her up and down, noting the burned scrapes, the tears in her uniform, and the wooden Bokuto in her hands, and smirked. "Release your foolish quest," Toga said, trying his charm one last time. "You can't save this world. Leave Sephiro to its fate. Don't be consumed by it." "And let my friends die? I don't think so. I've got some karma backlogged here, and I'm about to pay some of it off." "You're unarmed," he said, putting a hand to the grip of his lightsaber. "Sionji still has his flaws with a lightsaber. I have no such weaknesses." Anne shifted her grip on Teneri Koken. "I don't think so," she repeated, and swung the Bokuto back in preparation to strike. "You stupid girl," he exclaimed. "You are courting your own death. What is a wooden practice sword to a knight of the Black Rose?" "What the hell do you care anyway?" Anne snarled through her angry grin. She snapped the Bokuto forward in a hissing slice, only to have him gesture at her negligently. What felt like a fist of solid air crashed into her solar plexus, driving her backward several feet before she toppled and fell. As she got to her feet, swearing in all the various languages she'd learned during her impromptu underworld tour of the Outer Rim, Toga scowled at her. Then he smiled. "You're too late regardless," Toga said. With the snap hiss that was characteristic of a lightsaber, he ignited his weapon, swung the plasma beam disdainfully, and sliced the pyramid in half. The two halves fell apart with a clatter on the floor of the dueling platform, and angry red lightning burst out of the top, arcing up to blast across the minarets of the castle hanging above the platform. For a moment there was silence, and then with a crack of thunder the inverted towers began to fall, shedding bits down onto the heads of the two people below. Anne backpedaled away from the explosion and hastily erected a TK shield over her head, just in time, as a particularly large branch clunked off it and clattered to the ground. As she looked up, she saw the ghostly form of a huge wingless dragon, outlined in red lightning, churning amidst the spires of the castle in the sky. She tore her gaze away to stare at Toga in horror.
"You..."
"Now," he said, smiling smugly, "it's time for you to die." Anne gathered her wits and her wrath, pulled herself together. Narrowing her eyes, she brought her Bokuto back into ready position, and as she did, she heard Caitlin Sensei's words on her lips. "Bring it." Toga darted forward, his lightsaber flashing forward in a lunge reminiscent of a fencer's thrust. Anne silently thanked Miki and flowed out of the way of the plasma blade, whipping her Bokuto around in a slice for Toga's unprotected side. He snapped his saber back in a backhanded cut, faster than she was expecting, and caught the wooden blade on his own. The plasma blade let out an electric scream as the force of her blow drove it into Toga's side, and he gasped in pain and shock. Anne smiled nastily, and took the opportunity to smash her left fist into his bewildered expression, and she felt bone grind under her hand before he disengaged and pulled back a few steps. She had the satisfaction of seeing a blood-dark bruise begin to spread around his left eye. "So your wooden sword can't be cut," he said thickly, leveling the lightsaber at her. "Point for you," Anne growled softly. 2 points for me." "A root from the castle." "Wait, that's right, the castle's the roots of the world tree." Smacked into her shoulder, and Toga smirked as she yelped. 2 points for me. You cannot block the branches and fight at the same time." He charged again, and Anne parried frantically as she saw another tree branch swoop from behind him and head straight for her face. Dodging and weaving, she felt the lightsaber nip her on the shoulder and leave a burning track of pain behind it, before she dropped to her knees and rolled sideways beyond its reach. As she did so, she dropped her shields again. Empathy was a poor substitute for precognition in a fight, but it was better than nothing, and it had helped her against Sionji. She felt a wave of hatred, laced faintly with madness, reaching out from his mind toward her. Rather than wait for him to grab more branches to throw at her, she surged back to her feet with a yell, took one lunging step toward him, and their weapons clashed together before he jerked back, tried a cut for her side, which she parried. She counter-thrust, sliding the Bokuto along the lightsaber. It made a terrible noise, and lunged for his liver. He blocked, and came down in an overhand cut for her head, and then both of them jerked apart, and another root, a good 9 feet long, crashed down between them like a falling tree. She felt another wave of hatred wash over her, for the uniform she wore, for the fact that she wouldn't just lie down and let him win, for the fact that she was, barely, holding her own. "You can't win," he growled as he deflected another branch to the ground just beyond her. "Bite me," she snarled back. "If you give up now, I might make things easier for you," he said as he leapt over the root and brought his saber down in an overhand cut that she caught on her own weapon, perilously close to her hands. She struggled against his weight for a moment, then surged upward and brought her knee into his chest, driving the wind out of his lungs. He recovered almost instantly, but it bought her enough time to make her own attack, trying to hit the hilt of the lightsaber in hopes of breaking it. "Not interested," she growled as he parried, gasping and glaring. Another blow from that unseen force that he commanded knocked her backward, skidding across the pavement, giving him enough time to catch his breath. And then he smirked. "What a pity," he mused, and his gaze flicking to something behind her gave her just enough warning to roll with the knotted, stringy root that smashed into her back. She barely avoided impaling herself on his readied lightsaber, but she took the fall hard and Teneri Kokkan skittered out of her hands and across the stones of the dueling floor. He walked over and leveled the lightsaber at her throat as she tried to get up. "You're beaten, baby. There's no way you can compete with me."
"Sure there is," she gasped.
Narrowing her eyes, she telekinetically yanked Teneri Kokkan back into her hands, rolled over and swatted the lightsaber away, earning another burn on the collarbone as his eyes widened in amazement and he reacted picoseconds too late. He tried to lunge forward fast enough to impale her and failed. "Sheer cussedness has outlasted you before," she taunted. That brought another surge of rage out of him, and his eyes went manic with hatred for a moment as he roared wordlessly and slashed his lightsaber at where she'd been instants before, leaving gouges and scars in the dueling floor. She jumped backward, covering about 10 feet, landed, and set herself against the charge she could almost see in his mind. He dashed forward, locked blades with her, and pushed. Anne felt every muscle in her arms scream as she did her best to hold against him. His height gave him the high ground as he bore down on her, and her heels skidded backward over the stones. "This is over now," Toga sneered through the locked blades, his eyes lit from within by an insane glee. "You can't match me strength for strength. I'll take your blade, your body, your will, and then, when you finally beg me for it, I'll take your life, baby." "Never call me baby," Anne snarled, her eyes flashing with their own scarlet fire. Suddenly, Toga's face was in flames. Howling with unexpected anguish, he reeled, unlinking their weapons and staggering back. Anne regained her balance, set her feet, and thrust her left hand out, palm open. TK slammed into him like a speeding brick wall, catapulting him back. His lightsaber spiraled away, clattering across the platform before fetching up hilt first in one of the crenellations. He stumbled back against another one, barely caught himself before he began to fall. The fire had already gone out, and it hadn't really done him all that much harm. It just gave her the distraction and the instant she'd needed. He stared at her with wide, furious eyes, shockingly white against the blackness of his scorched face. Anne gave him no more time to recover. With a full-throated cry of, "Hyaken no Arashi!" she launched herself at him like a sprinter from starting blocks. The storm of 100 blades broke whatever concentration he might have mustered for himself. A dull wooden bokuto ordinarily does not cut anything. But the power of Anne's concentration wreathed to Narikokan in flames and gave it an edge, and Toga found himself cut to scorched ribbons in a little less time than it took him to inhale to scream. And then it was over, and Anne was standing in front of him with her bokuto swung back, in the preparatory position for an iaijutsu dueling cut. "Sayonara, jackass," she snarled, then slammed the wooden blade across his torso. The blow bit deeply into his side before she jerked the bokuto out and slammed him backwards over the crenellation, nearly cut in twain. He screamed his rage and hatred as he fell, and she watched impassively as the mists swallowed him up and snuffed out his voice. Only then did she turn away to look up at the red lightning worm ravaging the castle. "There is an eagle on the topmost branch of the world tree, and a dragon that gnaws at its roots," she thought. "A squirrel runs between them, carrying rumors and abuse, for the eagle is a guardian and the dragon is a destroyer. The dragon cannot be slain, but with it there are a host of worms that are its spawn. So what's the dragon's name? Ah. Nobody ever tells you you have to deal with a dragon that's legendary in its destructive powers after you beat the bad guy," she thought grimly. "Gunnar, please help me remember the right words for this challenge. Spawn of Nidhoggr, stand forth and do battle!" she yelled as loud as she could, issuing the formal challenge that she had learned from Gunnar, that were the opening words in a ritual duel between two immortal beings. Anne wasn't an immortal being, but the worm ravaging the castle certainly was, and it didn't seem terribly interested in leaving its current employment. The worm turned away from the castle, peered down at her. There was a long moment, and then it confirmed that Anne had, in fact, gotten the words right, as it loosed its grip on the spires and dove at her, trailing sparks and the roaring sound of thunder. Anne swallowed. "Gods, give me strength," she prayed, gripping her bokuto with suddenly sweaty hands. The dragon belched lightning at her as it dove, and she dodged a blast that singed the area she'd been standing in. Then it was swooping by and coiling up for another dive. "I never have a shotgun when I need one," Anne raged silently as she waited for it to come back down. "Crap, I'm going to have to hit it as it goes by. The timing on this is going to be..." Her train of thought rapidly shifted tracks as the worm finished banking and dove at her again, spewing another gout of lightning at her as it came. She waited, then launched herself upwards, powering her leap kinetically, brought her Bokuto slicing down through its neck with all her weight as it flowed beneath her like a snake of smoke and lightning. The ghostly worm shrieked in pain. The noise was like feedback in a guitar amp, and Anne misjudged her landing distance as the awful noise brought tears to her eyes. Her right ankle let out a cracking noise, the sort that joints really shouldn't make, and shooting pain surged up her leg, making her gasp and struggle not to drop her weapon to clutch at the point of pain. When she was done concentrating on that, she tried to stand again, to get into stance, but her ankle collapsed beneath her. Kneeling, she looked up through teary eyes as the roaring worm finished banking midair and turned, coming at her like an oncoming train. Anne shut her eyes and took a deep breath. There is no future. There is no past. There is only this moment, my opponent, the blade in my hands, and a fire in my heart. She opened her eyes and waited, Bokuto poised. The worm belched smoke and fury at her, and lightning exploded around her. Her heart spasmed, her arms jerked as the electrical onslaught grounded itself out through her flesh and bone to the floor of the dueling arena. The acrid smell of singed hair inflicted itself upon her nostrils. Then the smell of ozone hit her, overwhelmed the smell of burning flesh. She blinked once, her eyes going to burning, furious red as she ducked her shoulder, rolled, snapped the blazing Teneri Koken out to the left and caught the worm at the corner of its gaping maw. The burning Bokuto tore a gash along the entire length of its body as the serpent flowed by, shrieking in pain, and lightning poured out of the cut and electrified the whole area. Anne held her pose as it finished its pass, surged skyward, gave a final scream, and then exploded altogether, raining a few more bits of the castle down upon her head. She stared out at the edge of the dueling arena, feeling sweat dripping down her nose and her heart quivering slightly in her chest as the after effects of being struck by lightning made her muscles twitch. "I think I would like to lie down now," she thought weakly, then lowered her quenched Bokuto and crumpled slowly to the cool flagstones of the arena floor. Her burns ached for a second, but the world was starting to go gray and distant, so she didn't really notice. "Wow," she thought weakly, as the feeling of distance began to swallow her. "I guess I won." Then she heard a startled voice say something she couldn't quite make out, and the world went away entirely. Elsewhere. Sayanji awoke to cool hands on his forehead, a throbbing headache centered just above his left ear, and a distinct ringing in his ears. He groaned, and the hands shifted to his shoulders and held him down. "Don't move, Sayanji," said a soft voice, and he opened his eyes. Mia Ausa's face swam into view in a double refraction of unconnected vision. "You have a concussion and a cracked skull. Who hit you? The Rose Knight?" "Juniper," he groaned. Muzzily, he realized that if Mia was with him, he was probably back in Orifus. That meant he had to guard his words. He wished he could think clearly. Mia blinked, then said in a sardonic, unsympathetic tone of voice, "You got hit by a shrub?" Her face, what he could make out of it around the rainbows haloing her, looked disgusted. The noise in his ears altered slightly. Was somebody else in the room? He couldn't pick out anything clearly. It was hard to think. "No," he mumbled. "Caitlin's student. Did Toga..." "Oh, her," Mia said. Then she snorted derisively and shook her head. "Toga didn't do any better against her than you did. Worse, in fact. I think Nanami got sent to scrape him off the ground and put the burn bits someplace he could regenerate. You just have a bruised brain. He heard her smirk. What's it feel like to encounter something that your fancy sword can't cut?
If you fix my head, he rasped, I'll tell you.
Mia eyed him with an expression he was pretty sure was disgust, and then she sighed.
I suppose I'd better.
Lord Akio is going to want to talk to you. Just remember you owe me, Sayanji, and I will collect.
I'll remember, Mia,
he thought silently, as he heard her move around the room, and then the ringing in his ears got louder. When he could hear again, she was standing over him. Open your mouth, she said, sliding one arm under his shoulders to help him sit up a little. His stomach roiled, and he had to concentrate on not giving in to the nausea for a moment. Finally, he let her pour whatever it was down his throat. It tasted like a potion he'd had several times. Though she was a talented sorceress and alchemist, Mia couldn't make this type herself. So now he owed her a healing, too, along with everything else. His memory didn't feel particularly whole either, but he remembered what he owed her.